My goodness. Cast of thousands. Hello. Okay, that's fine. This is a story about how I got involved in Buddhism, and I've never, as I said, I've never shared this story, so, but I thought it might be appropriate tonight. If you get bored, you can go to sleep. I was 9 years of age, actually, going way back in ancient history to 1962. Ooh. Ancient history. And I grew up in Sydney, and I remember standing, and I grew up in middle-class suburb, quite a comfortable existence. And I remember standing outside in my backyard, very clearly, I was about nine, and I remember looking up at the stars and the sky. It was just going on evening. And I thought to myself, what is going on? What is this existence? I was really puzzled by it. Up until that time, I don't think I'd given it much thought. But all of a sudden, I realised that I didn't actually know what was going on. Yes, I went to school and my father had a job and my mother cooked dinner and my brother annoyed me and, you know, all the things that you normally do as a kid. But I didn't know what was going on. And I remember looking back at the house and thinking, they don't know either. Because I figured if my parents knew what was going on, they'd tell me. Now, what I meant by going on was, what actually was this whole thing about? Why was I on the planet? And why was this all going on? So that was my first inquiry into what was happening. And this may ring a bell for some of you, it may not. And I'm going to, oh, by the way, after I've given you my story, I'm going to ask some of you your stories, okay? So. So I want to know, actually, I want to know what drew you to Buddhism, because it's helpful for everybody to get a different perspective, okay, to see what drew us there and why we would continue. So after 9 years of age, I then explored various things. I explored other religions. I looked at Christianity quite strongly up until probably about the age of 13. I kind of was interested in it. And I actually did, funnily enough, at the school I went to, it was a Christian school, and I came first in all the Christian subjects to do with Christianity very easily, because I was absorbing this information, because I got some inkling that the great religions of the world had some of the juice, had some of the information, because I figured everything else didn't. You know, the football team I played with wasn't giving me the answers to the universe. And nothing else seemed to be. So I was looking at that. But if you can imagine, 1962 in Australia, there was almost no word of Buddhism. If there was, it was some quaint religion that people looked at on bookshelves. There was no one practicing. I didn't know any Buddhists. I'd never come across any, particularly in the lifestyle I led. So, and we didn't do comparative religions at school. So all we had was Christianity. But for some reason, I didn't get quite the answers I was after. It wasn't a negative so much as just not enough. And if we even look at the teachings of Christianity, Jesus was on the planet for 3 years in terms of his teaching ministry. 3 years. And the Buddha was over 50. So the Buddha had the opportunity to impart an incredible amount of information, whereas Jesus had 3 years. Also, at the time that the Buddha was teaching, he was teaching to the most intelligent people of that time. Now, if we can remember, and I diverge a bit, I'll get back to my story in a minute. Diverge a little bit. At around 500 BC was a time when the Buddha was alive. Mahavira, who started the Jain religion, was born 12 years after the Buddha. Pythagoras, Lao Tzu and Confucius were all wandering around the planet. It was known as the golden time of wisdom. But in Australia in 1962, I didn't really have that. We just had one. So I examined that up until about 13, and then I had a very strange experience. I was going to a thing they had after church was, and I didn't go regularly, I wasn't so interested in the ceremony, I was really more interested in the information. And I would go to the fellowship afterwards. And I remember, I don't know what it was, I'd read some book, and I was starting to have some doubts about the way this particular religion looked at things. I just kind of wasn't putting it together. And I went to this minister, and I said to him, if I live a very, very good life, and I do everything that I can right, but I'm not a Christian, what happens to me? He said, well, you don't go to heaven. And I went, and I must say, this was a very narrow view. I have since come across a lot more Christians in this day and age that don't think that way. But this was just my interface with this one guy. I picked the wrong bloke, actually. And then I said, and if I'm, and say I even sacrifice my life for somebody else. He said, no, you don't enter the kingdom of heaven unless you believe. And I said, and on the other hand, I'm a guy that doesn't do very much. I don't do as much as this other guy, but I believe in Jesus, I go to heaven. He went, yeah. And I went, nah, you lost me. And I actually walked out the door. Now, you know, I'm not putting Christianity down because I think it's an extraordinary religion. And in fact, Christianity and Buddhism is very close together. Very, very, very similar in its deep philosophy. But I didn't know the deep philosophy. I was getting churchianity rather than Christianity as I was growing up. So then I started searching. And I started looking at martial arts, and I studied martial arts for 6 years. And I couldn't find it there, and I studied yoga. And I was getting little bits. From martial arts, I got mental discipline. I sort of understood that, and I thought, okay, there's something here. Some flavour. It was Japanese karate, actually, at the time. Then I studied some Hindu yoga, and I got more stuff. But it still wasn't actually giving me exactly what I was after. At about the age 23, I was with my wife at the time. I'd been married very young. And I was in Brisbane. And I had met this woman who had been a cook at the first Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Queensland called Chenrezig Institute. And she was an incredible lady. She was really wild. And I really liked her energy. She was full on. She was loud. She was exuberant in everything she did. But there was an incredible joy about her. And she said that she'd been a cook for the Tibetan lamas that had come over, Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe. And she said, look, my wife and I were in a country town, and we actually had to get to Brisbane to get some work. And she said, look, come with me, and you can stay in this place. There's plenty of rooms. My friends won't mind. You can stay there. So we stayed with her. And this one Saturday, she said to me, look, I'm going to Chenrezig Institute this afternoon. About 12, 1 o'clock, I think she said. Do you want to come? And I went, Buddhism, yeah, maybe, maybe not. I had a friend that had become a Buddhist, and he seemed quite strict in his views, and I didn't want to be that strict. I was 23, and you know, kind of wanted things to be a bit cruisy. And I went, oh, look, maybe. Anyway, went off into town. As we're walking back, I turned to my wife and I said, do you want to go to this Buddhist monastery? And she said, yeah, okay. I said, look, we're really running late. I don't think we're going to make it. I said, look, if I put my hand out in the taxi, zoom, stops. And I went, ooh. that's a bit scary. No, that's just a coincidence. So we get in the cab, and we have to go back to the house to pick up some clothes to go away for the weekend. And I went, no, come on. By the time we get back there, the train, we're going to get there, we're going to have to go inside, pack some clothes. The taxi will go, because we can't afford to keep waiting. We were very poor. We're going to miss the train. And she was like, oh, yeah, okay. So I thought, oh, well, that doesn't matter. We'll just go back and spend the weekend in Brisbane in this house. As the cab pulls up, there's our friend walking out with our bags. I went, what? She said, I knew you were coming. nah, coincidence. So then the cab takes us off to the train, and I'm going, no, we've missed the train. Walk up the stairs, and the train goes, it's running late. Junk. I'm thinking, there's something about this that's going on here that's a little bit more out of my control. Anyway, we got to the station, this little station called Udlow, in the middle, about an hour and a half from Brisbane. Beautiful countryside, it was summertime. And we get out and we start walking along this dirt road, just the three of us. And it was kind of magical. I felt like I was going on this really unusual adventure. I felt like I was kind of exploring the wilds of some unknown, I mean, it was Queensland, so I was quite right, the unknown world. And we came to this little house, and the lady said, oh, look, we'll drop in and say hello to someone. So we walked in, and she said, and the road up to Chen Raising Institute goes up the mountain like that afterwards, and we'll walk up, but we'll just go and say hello and, you know, have a cup of tea. And walk in, and I meet my first Buddhist nun. A lady called Anila Ann. She was a Westerner. She was a Canadian. She'd been a nun for many years. She was in full Tibetan robes. And I was just fascinated with her. I had never met anyone that was completely at ease. I'd met many people up until the age of 23, not as many as I've met so far. But I just noticed there was this incredible quality of comfort. She seemed very comfortable in her skin. And she felt so comfortable in her skin, I felt very uncomfortable in mine. I kind of didn't know what to say, and I didn't know where to look, and kind of look at the nun or not look at the nun or have the tea. And I felt very, very, very weird about the whole thing, but still fascinated by this woman's presence. She had an extraordinary presence. So we had tea and we talked for a while, and then she said, well, you know, I'll see you up at the monastery later, I'll catch you later. She said, there's no lamas there at the moment. She said, it's very quiet for the weekend. Just, you know, hang out, no problem. Someone will look after you when you get there. There's no rules particularly, just. So we wandered up. And I remember wandering up through this roadway, and it felt like I was climbing out of, actually it was weird, it was like climbing out of samsara. It was this very strange experience. I felt like I was doing this strange adventure. The whole thing seemed very surreal, and I look back at it, and in many ways it really was surreal for me. I hadn't made the decision to investigate Buddhism. I'd read a couple of little books on Buddhism and thought it was interesting, but it hadn't really attracted me at all. I was more attracted to martial arts and even Hinduism, actually. And I'm walking up this road with my wife, and I'm feeling like I'm kind of going to the God realms. It was quite bizarre. We came to the big gates, and there were sort of Tibetan flags and a couple of pillars. I walked through the gates and I stopped dead. And I turned to my wife and I said, I've just come home. There was this incredible experience of, well, I didn't know I was looking for home, actually. I thought my home was back in Sydney. And I thought, I've just come home. And there was this incredible sense of recognition. Now, let's face it, here there was this monastery built. Has anyone been to Chen Raising Institute in Queensland? Probably haven't. Just this hillside with a temple at the top and a kitchen on the side, and, you know, it's not sort of landscape at that stage. It's more landscape these days, but at that stage in 1973 or 4, it was 74, 75 actually, it was very, very new. And there was a lot of bush. But I got this instant recognition that I had found the place that I was looking for. And that was the beginning of my Buddhism. I actually never looked back. I realized there and then that Buddhism was actually the practice that I wanted to embark on. Right, now that's my story. Does anyone else, and you don't have to go into the full bit, because I'm sitting out the front and I've got the floor, haven't I? what I want to know is, there are various things, various reasons why, and I'll make it a little bit easier rather than you having to go through your own story. There are various reasons why we approach a religion, or particularly Buddhism. maybe we're unhappy. Maybe we feel a sense of dissatisfaction in our lives. And naturally, if you're dissatisfied with something, if you don't feel comfortable with something, you start looking for something else. All right? If you are on a smorgasbord of different foods and you eat one that you don't like, you don't stay with it, do you? You go, oh, I think I might try another one. So in terms of unhappiness, if we're feeling unhappy, we will look for some reason or some way out of that happiness. So in a sense, we're actually looking for happiness. We're looking to feel more comfortable. Some of it, like myself, I wasn't particularly unhappy, well, not consciously, but I just wanted to know what was going on. And when I started to investigate Buddhism, I found out that it really had an extraordinary handle on what was going on, how things fitted together, how the universe fitted together, how human relationships fitted together, how this connected web that we all are involved in of humanity and animals and beings and planets and universes had this connective web. And I realized that the Buddha had actually put this information in a way that I could understand it, and a way that seemed actually very real to me. So for me, it was a desire to understand. Now, how many people have come to Buddhism for that reason, that they wanted to understand stuff? Yeah? Okay? Two? Yeah. What's going on? And does this Buddha, this practice of Buddhism, actually have the information? Okay, who else came to it because they were feeling uncomfortable? No? Okay. Who came to it because of a background? Their parents or their relationships? Okay? So a lot of you, because you've been brought up that way, it feels familiar. Are there any other reasons? Because I want to know. Are there any other reasons why the people that didn't put up their hands for any of those categories, you're on the spot now. All right? So I want some answers. I'll lock the door. Okay, go on. Ah, okay. Okay.
And also for the sense of community. So I felt not so very at home with community that I ended up with.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm going to say something about that later. Thank you for that. Okay, so what was your name?
Long time.
Wanted to feel a sense of peace, was it? The sense of meditation or? Okay, I'm going to ask you to qualify the word helpful.
It seemed to open up a whole new world
for me. Okay, keep going.
And I guess it's something I can't quite put into
words. Okay, I'm getting that. Would it be giving you a sense of peace? Would that be it?
More of reality.
Ah, okay. A sense of looking at reality, is it?
Yeah,
because meditation does some very interesting things. It very much grounds you, doesn't it? Gives you a base. Because, well, look, if meditation does many things, I mean, apart from training the mind, but it creates a sense of balance in your life, okay? So it creates this sense of harmony. One thing meditation doesn't do, hopefully, is agitate the mind, okay? Because we have agitated minds normally, but when we meditate, have you noticed how the mind, after a period of time, just settles out? And then afterwards, if you've ever done weekends of meditation, you'll notice how your mind is after that. It becomes very even. So that when things that come into it start to ruffle it, you deal with it in a different way. So in a sense, what meditation does, it calms the mind down. Creates harmony in the mind. Now, R9, or bit later than that, aren't we? What time do we normally whack out of here, guys?
Around 9:30.
9:30?
Okay. Can you just switch the lights?
We can do that.
You've got to slam the door, make sure.
Who's running the show here? Okay. Okay. You got it?
Okay. Just make sure switch off the lights and slam the door shut.
Thank you very much. Okay, good on you. I thought he was going to join us for a minute. So meditation gives you this sense of to use term Goenka used, equanimous of the mind. It's not a word, but he used this word. It means equal. And out of an agitated mind comes all the things we don't need in our lives. Anger, hatred, miserliness, dissatisfaction, depression, bad judgment. All the things we don't need comes out of an agitated mind. When the mind's agitated, we just don't make good decisions. We affect our relationships in a negative way. We're not nice to be with when we're really agitated. So, conversely, a mind that is peaceful, a mind that is calm, is really pleasant to be around. This is exactly what I found with this nun that I met at Chenrezig Institute. She was just nice to hang around. I wasn't asking her any deep questions. She was just pleasant to be in her company because her mind, I perceive, was very peaceful. It was just nice to hang out with her. There was a sense of ease in the communication. There was even, during that weekend, we kind of sat with her, and there were times where, and I've experienced this with many well-experienced meditators, often there wasn't conversation. It's just a sense of being. And so...
Sorry, I'm late. No problem. I went to the old building.
Oh, no problem. Glad you could make it. Ah, good. The lifeline.
Yeah,
that's true. Okay, so this sense of ease comes out of this practice of meditation. One of the other things that comes out of meditation, I see my mate up there, is the idea of mindfulness. This ability to have the mind on the present. And that's something that we often don't do. And that's what I mean by bringing us back to reality, and this is a good point that you made, the reality of things, because living in the past and living in the future is not reality. The present is, and meditation, in a sense, trains our mind to be present. And this is really important for our daily living. It's important for everything that we do. All car accidents, apart from alcohol and speed, are caused by not being mindful, by distraction. Yeah, but when the mind is not consciously aware, or if you happen to be doing your iPhone and driving, a new phenomena that's crept in the last 10 years, people crashing while they're texting, and it's all distraction. So meditation stops that distraction. And so yes, meditation is one of the reasons, obviously, why someone would come to Buddhism. Because in fact, I remember a Catholic priest rang me up one time and he said, "Look, I'm a Catholic priest. Do you mind if I come to your Buddhist centre?" I said, no, not at all. I said, "We do teachings on Thursday night." He said, "I reckon you guys have got the best handle on meditation, and I thought I'd go to the top." And he came along and he learnt the meditation. After 3-4 sessions of meditation, he got it and he said, "Thanks very much, that's fabulous, that's just what I was after." And that was fantastic. You know, there is a guy who just worked out that the Buddhists knew how to meditate. He wasn't getting quite the meditation he wanted from his Christian practice, and so off he came, and wonderful, fantastic. And that's how we actually can be of benefit to the other great religions in the world, that we can really be open, that we don't make them say, "Okay, no, if you're a Catholic priest, no, if you're going to come here, you have to stop being a Catholic priest and now become a Buddhist and we'll teach you to meditate." No, we're completely open. Whoever wants to learn, very happy to teach. Atheists, anybody, doesn't matter. And that's where we can be generous with our practice. We're not discriminatory. So, the need for peace and harmony. That's one of the reasons that people come to Buddhism. Now, you said meditation. Was there anyone else here who didn't stick their hand up who's brave enough to tell me why they embarked we'll call it an investigation of Buddhism, because I think we're still investigating. I hope we are.
Yeah, Yep. So I went to all the lives, sort of kindergarten type thing, not kindergarten, Sunday school thing for a while.
Yep.
When I was young.
Yep.
I sort of didn't do that long, and after a while, I used to go to Timaru, this is in New Zealand, and there was a thing called Open Air Campaigners, which was a Christian outreach thing.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone would sort of sit around and sing songs and stuff.
Yep.
Which was a bit of fun.
Yep.
But that didn't really sort of have a lasting impact on me.
Yep.
But then later on, I had this year of intense Christianity, went home and spent the time reading the Bible 3.5 times. And
wow,
that.
That's impressive, yeah.
But I sort of got disenchanted after a while. For a while there, I was sort of really into it. I had this 47 Chevy, big black car.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to pick up all the kids in the neighborhood and take them to the church.
Yeah.
As a part of that trip.
Right.
And all the mothers looked a bit distracted, you know, being, taking their children away in the big car.
No.
But, yeah, there was this sort of conflict between the Pentecostal people and the people that wanted to have their traditional Christianity in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this sort of infighting and it's a very negative thing.
Yeah.
And so that forced me to break away, I suppose.
Yeah.
But later I did a history and a politics degree and did all this classic studies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I developed all these philosophical insights and stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's what's led me to Buddhism, really, the depth of the philosophy and the loving kindness and things like that.
Fantastic. Oh, great. Thank you for sharing that. That's great. So here we're looking at, it's interesting that all of our experience so far, apart from people that have come from a cultural background, is this desire to know more. And what's important too is, and this is partly it, and I'll actually go through this a little bit clearer. I've got some points here that I want to make, and I didn't want to miss out on them. There's this desire for maybe more compassion, more understanding of compassion, or a way. I know one of my friends wanted to be more compassionate in her life. She actually wanted to know how to develop her compassion. And she found that the teachings of the Buddha were an incredible way to do that. That there were particular technologies, informations, and methods of developing one's compassion. And the two most important things, well, the three most important things that we have in Buddhism are renunciation. It's often depicted by the lotus. Why the lotus? Come on, some of you all know this one. Why is the lotus depicted as renunciation? Don't rush me with answers.
Yes, it's being folded together.
No, at least you gave it a shot. Come on, you lot. Why is the lotus considered to be renunciation? Yeah, come on. Yeah, everybody probably knows. No one's just going to say it. The lotus grows out of delusion, the mud of delusion and ignorance and grasping. And the lotus is pure. It grows out of muddy water. So out of this mess that we have of delusion and ignorance comes the lotus. And the lotus is the renunciation of negative states of mind and the causes of negative states of mind. If you don't renounce negative states of mind, you have no hope. There isn't any hope if you don't renounce negative states of mind. If you think lying, cheating, stealing, killing, and everything else that goes with the negative state of mind is a good idea, then better you join the mafia. Because it doesn't work for Buddhism. And it doesn't work for happiness. And we'll get into that in a little while. So we have the lotus. So renunciation, renouncing negative states of mind. On top of that, we have a moon cushion, which is in the Tibetan system, which represents compassion. The real desire to see all beings free from suffering. Remove the suffering of all beings, without exception. Because if you could imagine that all beings were free of suffering, then there would be no persecution, no anger, all our delusions come out of, well, sorry, all our negative actions come out of delusion, which brings anger, hatred, and desire. But with this idea of compassion, we're wishing all beings to be free of that, and if they're all free of that, then the harmony amongst all beings happens. And then on top of that, we have the sun cushion, which represents wisdom. And it's very interesting that wisdom and compassion come together. It's a very, very important reason for that. If we have compassion without wisdom, we have a bit of a problem. What's the problem? That's right. And we can call it idiot compassion eventually, where you have decided to take a little old ladies across the road because you're a compassionate person, whether they want to go or not. Go on, you're coming across the road. I told this story once, and this person said, I did that once, and the lady hit me with an umbrella. So you have to have wisdom with compassion. You have to have wisdom with compassion, because otherwise you start doing things that you think are compassionate, and they're actually quite harmful, or they're not beneficial. If you have wisdom without compassion, you just have knowledge. You have information, but you have no action. Wisdom, from the Tibetan point of view, is the feminine quality, it's really interesting the way they reverse it. The sun is the feminine quality of wisdom, and it belongs to the female energy. Sorry, guys. Wisdom is a woman's domain. But action is the male, the moon, which is compassion. You need them both together. If you don't have those, you don't have right action. You have wisdom or information, but you don't have action. And so they're both together. So you have renunciation, compassion, and wisdom. Those three things are known, again, in the Tibetan system as the three principal paths, and they give rise to enlightenment. So in a way, Buddhism is very simple. Firstly, finding out states of mind, I'll put it that way, that are not beneficial. So negative states of mind. Find out what those are, and don't do them. Find out what are positive states of mind, or positive actions, and we do those. If we just did those in our lives with nothing more, then we would be creating a positive future, karma. So I'm going to move a little bit now into how to, I'll see how the time is. Oh no, we've got a bit more time. Okay, so we've gone into the understanding firstly of renunciation, then compassion. So we're avoiding negative states of mind, we're embodying positive states of mind, and then we have to also look beyond ourselves, and we have to develop compassion for all beings. If we become selective and say, no, I'm going to only be compassionate to you, and I'm going to miss out on you, then we start to create an imbalance. It's called enemies. And if we look at this planet, if we looked at this planet from the days that we were running around as cave people 200,000 years ago, unfortunately, we have not stopped having wars, we've not stopped anger, hatred, stealing, and negativity. Individuals, definitely. But en masse, as human beings, look at this planet at the moment. We look at global financial crisis, where greedy banks have done naughty things and ended up causing people a lot of suffering through greed. We see people taking over countries or not taking over countries or being despots or whatever and causing a great deal of suffering. And constantly this negative action happening all the time. Yep.
And
being so what?
This is true, then the logical path is simply to be observable of that and not be affected by it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not being caught up in it. If we start to feel, and we can feel a sense of injustice when people are persecuted, but if we run around and then start harming the perpetrators, nothing has changed. We create the same problem again. And if we keep doing that, then nothing changes. So as Buddhist practitioners, the Buddha was very, very clear about not harming. Not harming anybody. If you want someone to turn up in your life as a negative person in the future, be negative to them now. If you want a nasty person to go away, be very kind to them. It purifies your karma with them, and eventually, in a future time, they will turn up as a friend. So at some level, and I'll put that point too, of observance, but we also have to sometimes have action as well. The great leveller is knowing when to act and when not to act. Knowing when to be available to do something and when not to. And this is really what mindfulness is about. Having that very clear mind, knowing when to do an action and when not to do an action. And so this is what meditation and mindfulness achieves, this ability to be very, very focused on when to do the right thing. Because if we do it at the wrong time, if the timing's wrong, then things don't work so well. But we get very clear about action, though. Doing a positive action is very, very, very important in terms of our future karma. It's assuring our future life. Okay, now I'm going to jump to how we begin to be a Buddhist. Firstly, we have to look at the teachings of the Buddha, the things that we've just been discussing, and we have to run those through our own wisdom. The Buddha said, don't accept anything just because of your love for me. Accept it because you run it through your own wisdom. For me, when I heard this in Buddhism, it was the most incredible breath of fresh air for me to understand that I was allowed to examine these teachings. I didn't have to sign up to a religion and then have to accept all the tenets of that religion, and if I didn't accept it, then I was a heretic. I was given open ground by the Buddha himself, by the authority, to examine exactly what these particular things were. What the teachings of Buddhism were, and I was allowed to dissect it and pull it apart. I remember my very first teachings from my teacher Geshe Loden up in Chenrezig Institute, 1978 actually. And after every teaching he said, don't you take my word for it, you check up. Your own mind, you check up, don't you take my word for it. You see if this is correct. And I thought that was fantastic. I was allowed to use my own experience and my own understanding. And I had a friend a while ago who just embarking on, oh gosh, this is 10 years ago, embarking on just opening a Buddhist book, just a little bit. And then she'd ask me a couple of questions. And she'd say, oh look, I don't believe in rebirth. No way, not possible. I went, oh, that's okay, doesn't matter. You can be a Buddhist and not believe in rebirth. Makes it a little bit more complicated in getting your head around it in terms of karma, but that's no problem. Just 2 days ago, and she said, no, past lives, I can't get into it, future lives, no, don't get that bit, but I really like the idea of compassion and all these other things. So we've had dialogues over the last 10 years. She lives in the country. Just the other day, she was telling me about her son, who's 7 years of age, and they bought a piano, and just by coincidence, a classical piano teacher, concert pianist, moved in next door. And when she moved in next door, they asked this concert pianist whether she would just have a look at this young fella to see if she could teach him piano. And she said to me, the piano teacher came back and said she had never in her entire life seen anyone that could pick up the piano that quickly. She said he was beyond anything she'd come across. She'd been teaching piano for years. She was in her late 60s. And I said, yeah. I said, past lives. And she went, yeah. I said, I thought you didn't believe in past lives. She said, all right, I'm starting to waver. So I wasn't pushing it. She just started to go, yeah, that's a possibility. Where else would that ability come from? Her husband didn't play piano. She didn't play piano. They didn't even really play classical music in the house. And he was this kid with this unbelievable ability. Where did that come from? It wasn't genetic code in that family. So gradually over time, we have to examine the teachings. And there are some that we find a bit difficult, or we don't understand, or that aren't as juicy for us as others. That's fine. That's fine. Some of us will go towards the wisdom, some compassion. But in the end, they all come around together. You can't have the wisdom without compassion. You can't have the compassion without the wisdom. And there's many opportunities to use our wisdom and many opportunities to use our compassion. So in the end, if you live life, those teachings will come up. And you will then try to find out, when you come across a situation, if you use the information of Buddhism, to start to realise that that information is really extraordinary when you deal with people. Has anyone found that when they've really seen that their interaction of Buddhist principles has been really beneficial for themselves and others? I'm sure you have. Yeah. Why?
So, I suppose my actual involvement with Buddhism teaching actually comes from my auntie.
Yep.
So, I can say that I've noticed when I moved in to live with my auntie, that was a time when I was going through a lot of distress.
Yep.
And it was a time when my auntie was arguing, or my uncle was arguing with my auntie. And my auntie was just like, yeah, whatever.
Just being really easy with it.
Being really easy with it. So I was wondering, how does that work?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, what else does my auntie know that I don't know about?
Very interesting, isn't it? Well, that's the point. And funnily enough, you just said one of the things that I've got on my list here. Firstly, we look at the teachings of the Buddha, and we analyze them, and we see if they make sense. And if some of them make sense, well, that's good enough. When I first came across Buddhism, I didn't know the extraordinary depth of the teachings. I certainly didn't know about most of it, but whatever I got made sense. Now, and this is the next point, we need to look at the conduct of the Buddhist practitioners. We need to look at what we call Sangha. But if you're going to examine a system, then, well, I get, how can I put it in an analogy? If you were going to play in an orchestra and you wanted to learn violin and you were going to play in an orchestra, you'd want to see how well the orchestra played, wouldn't you? You'd also want to know that if you were going to learn from the person that was going to teach you, that was teaching the orchestra, whether they could play. So if you went in to play the violin and you heard them, they were completely all out of tune and it sounded awful, you'd start to wonder who was teaching them, and you'd start to doubt the teachings of that violin teacher within that. So what we also need to look at is the practitioners of doing the practice of the Buddha. We need to look at the community of people around us. So that's another way of examining. We look at the conduct of those people. And in my experience, the people that I've grown up with that have been Buddhist for many years, I've found that the quality of their relationships are incredible. The forgiveness, the understanding, and the wisdom. I have other friends. I was saying this about someone the other day to my wife, and she said, oh, that person's kind of got a funny view on that. And I said, yeah, I can't talk to them about that because they're not Buddhist. And they don't have this idea of complete understanding around this area. They're still caught up in, it was about something to do with blame. They're still caught up in blame. And I said, I can't tell them that the root cause is their own karma. I said, because they're not Buddhists and it would be an imposition. But they're wandering around blaming someone for their misfortune. And once you blame someone else, or something else, your misfortune, you're at the mercy of that situation. One of my friends, a Buddhist monk, said one time, brand new beginners, I might have told you this once before, they're all sitting there, all very eager to listen to Buddhism. They'd never come to Buddhism before, and he said, "You want to know something? It's all your fault. Everything you experience is your fault." And he said, and that's the good news. He said, because if it's someone else pulling the strings, you can never change. If you recognize, if you firmly recognize that everything that happens to you is a result of your own causes and conditions from previous time, then you have to accept it openly. Who are you going to blame? Your past incarnation? They're gone. The previous stream of consciousness that before Rod Lee, finished. The best that I can do is make sure that this incarnation does as many right things so that the next guy doesn't get angry with me, or girl, or caterpillar, as the case may be. Do you see what I'm getting at? So once we take the responsibility on ourselves, then we have a lot of scope. If we walk around going, "Oh, I failed because," or "I didn't do this because," or, you know, sometimes it seems as though the fault is the other person. But ultimately it comes back to our karma. And this is a way that we're able to deal with very, very difficult situations. I know some Jewish friends of mine said that during the Holocaust, when the Jewish people were being persecuted, many Jewish people lost their faith because they couldn't understand why a loving God would persecute them as such. And it became very difficult for them. I have a Jewish friend whose daughter died with a brain tumor, and she kept saying to me, why would this happen to my daughter? How could this possibly happen? And again, not being a Buddhist, I couldn't say to her, this is a, because it would sound cruel. She'd think, "Oh, it's my daughter's fault." She said she's lived a good life, she wasn't that old. But from a Buddhist perspective, we know that unfortunate circumstances happened from previous causes and conditions. It doesn't stop it being very sad and tragic, but it does give us some way of handling the truth of the situation. And I'd never come across these teachings until I came across Buddhism. I never had a template of dealing with this, the difficulties of life, until I came across the way the Buddha explained it, which I then could see was great reality. And then coming across the most extraordinary Buddhist teachers that I've come across, realizing the way that they lived their lives was absolutely the way the Buddha had instructed them to. And then you look at the wealth of Buddhist practitioners from 2,500 years ago, and the enlightened minds and the wisdom and the commentaries on the extraordinary teachings of the Buddha, and we start to realize that we're very, very privileged to have come across Buddhism. Unbelievably privileged. Because it gives us a way to be able to eventually be permanently happy. And so once we've looked at, firstly, the Buddha, and then we've looked at some of the teachings, and then we've looked at the conduct of the Sangha and the people that are following the teachings, and we start to get some feedback that, you know, things are going okay, we then start to look at what teaching do we first need to know. How do we embark on the practice of Buddhism? What's the first thing that we need to know? And you guys know it. What is it? What was the first teaching of the Buddha? Exactly, the Four Noble Truths. Yep. Yes, on the absolute limit of emptiness, that's correct. But we will get to that later.
No, it's
not. We've got an iconoclast in the class. The Four Noble Truths. Firstly, the Buddha was able... It's such brilliant teaching, really. The first teaching, he said, there is suffering. Now you can imagine, here's a new teacher on the planet, and he says there is suffering, and everyone goes, Yeah, actually there is. There's dissatisfaction. There's dissatisfaction. There is suffering. Okay, I get that. That's a truism. Ultimately, no. Relatively, yes. I remember, actually, I'm going to say a comment about that. There was a question to Lama Zongzha Khyentse Rinpoche, and he was talking about emptiness. And someone said, but Rinpoche, karma is empty also. And he said, empty of existence. And he said, karma is also empty. And the guy said that to the Rinpoche, and he said, yes, but for you, very real. And that's the truth of it. Until we see the reality of the nature of existence, which is wisdom, which is the wisdom part of those three things, the interdependence of all phenomena and the emptiness of inherent existence, until we see that, we are stuck. When we see that directly, then we become unstuck. And that's the important part, where we actually let go of this struggle. We're struggling against something that, I saw a wonderful quote the other night. It was, why are we unhappy? Because everything and every thought and every action that we do is for the self, and there isn't one. Get it? We are doing stuff for a self that doesn't exist. We have the emptiness of self. That doesn't mean that we don't experience things, but we are grasping onto an illusion. Anyway, that's getting into a different teaching at the moment. It's getting into emptiness. So we're looking at the Four Noble Truths. First, there is suffering. So that was pretty obvious. Yep, dissatisfaction, changeable suffering. What we think is happiness is suffering, or changeable suffering. Going to the beach. We lie on the beach. Oh, it's fantastic. Oh, it's so warm. It's nice. I'm really enjoying this beach. Whoa, it's starting to get really hot. Oh, now I'm really hot. Oh, dive in the water. Oh, that's just so fabulous. So what we've done is got rid of one suffering, right? By diving in the water. Stand in the water half an hour. This is getting really cold. I'm really cold. Now I'll go back on the sand. Oh, this sunshine is just so wonderful. So I've just ruined your day at the beach, sorry. What we think is happiness is actually changeable suffering. Quite amusing, really. The law of diminishing returns. One piece of chocolate is fabulous. 6 kilos, nah, not so great. Well, okay, 7 kilos. And we do this all the time. And once we, it doesn't mean that we can't enjoy things, but we often think that those things are happiness. I wanted to a book that one day I will write, and it might take a long while, but one of the chapters is, if only, then I'll be happy. All right? And the dot, dot, dot is whatever word you want to put in there. If only that person was in my life, then I'd be happy. If only that person was out of my life, then I'd be happy. If only I had a new car. Oh, if only someone hadn't scratched my new car. And it goes on and on and on. The suffering that we have is constantly changing, these changing circumstances. Getting what we don't want and not hanging on to what we do want. And if we start to look at that, and this is what the Buddha was really pointing at, it's non-attachment, we can start to let go and enjoy things as they are. I'll give you an example of a sunset. When we see a sunset, we're looking at this most beautiful sunset, all the skies lit up, and we're sitting there and we're going, hey, look at the sunset, isn't that fabulous? We know that it's impermanent. We enjoy it for exactly what it is at the time, and then it goes away. And that's every pleasure that we will ever have is exactly the same. And we're very lucky to have the joy of looking at a sunset. But if you try to capture it and hold it and, yeah, good, take it with your iPhone, but it ain't as good as standing there, I promise you. And that's exactly the way that all things are. They're impermanent. And if we actually get that really clearly, if we know that they're impermanent, then we can enjoy them for that brief moment that they are without any attachment to it. And it makes the mind far more accepting of the things that happen. Things that come in and things that go. I remember I was talking of cars, I was in a car park one time, and I just parked my car. It was an underground car park, and I was going to someone's apartment, and there were these two guys dancing around this Audi, this brand new sports Audi. I think it was one of the $180,000 models with, you know, supercharged V8 overhead running doors. And they were dancing around this car, and I got in the lift, and they got in the lift with me. And one of the guys said, "Oh, look, sorry about," he saw me there, he said, "sorry about it." He said, "I've just been trying to buy this car for so long, and I finally got the money to to get it, and I'm just so happy. I finally got the car that I was after." He was jumping up and down. I said, "Yeah, they're fabulous till the first scratch." And I'm sorry I did it, because I was kind of making a joke. His face just went as though he'd never entertained the possibility that that fabulous car would ever get scratched. And his friend went, "Yeah, that's a terrible time when that happens." And he's got and the guy, I'm thinking, oh, that was really unskillful. I'm really disappointed. He was so happy about this car, and all of a sudden I'm talking about prangs and scratches, and he's like, "Oh no." But that's the reality. That's the reality. I promise you, if that guy has that car for 3 or 4 years, he'll get a scratch. Either he'll do it or someone will do it, but he'll get a scratch. And then he'll relax, actually. Once the first scratch is gone, you're a bit better off. Has anyone had a new car and got the first scratch? No one? Yeah. It's awful, isn't it? Yeah, it's awful. Terrible. Secret, don't buy new cars. Buy a car that's already got scratch on it. Then you don't have to worry. So these are the humour I like about Buddhism. When you start to see the amusement of the way that we attach ourselves, and so it doesn't become a big deal. I had another friend who was at Chen Raising Institute, and he played this trick. Everyone was sitting there, new Buddhists, all sitting there being very, 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 very holy and mindful, and they get their food, and they've got their bowl of food, and they're offering it up to all sentient beings, and they're being really holy and pious, and he comes along and goes, "Oh, thank you," and they go, "Whoa!" He takes it away from them, and they're absolutely freaked out. And yet they've just offered it to all sentient beings. That's the humour that I like. And this is and that humour is really true. It's part of the amusement of looking at our human condition in the light of Buddhism and starting to see that we can lighten up a bit. We don't have to be so precious about our possessions. We can lighten up. And also looking at situations with friends. Like sometimes, and all of us will go through this, we have friends that are really close to us, and then one day something happens. It just stops. And we go, "What happened?" And they don't tell you what happened, and they're just not your friend anymore. And you go, "Oh, how can that happen?" Well, the Buddha said very clearly, friends become enemies, enemies become friends and change again. That's the nature of relationships. So if that's the reality, then okay, yes, we had a good friendship, okay, that's not happening now. Disappointing, yes. But really the essence, it doesn't mean that you won't have a reaction, it doesn't mean that you become bland, but that you don't hang on to it. That you don't hang on to the suffering. That, as one particular Lama said, he said, if your emotions start to roll off you like water off oil, doesn't mean that you don't have the emotion, but that you don't hang on to it. then you're doing okay. Then you're doing okay. Do you have a question over there? Yeah.
Yeah. I had a recurring thread of what you were speaking just now.
Yeah.
We sort of talked, when you were talking about how Buddhist teachings work around the idea of, well, you have something, you know, appreciate it for the moment while you have it, and then when you've lost it, you know, it's gone, you know, and you try to be happy with it, but the fact that you did have it. But what is the, I was wondering what is the approach in Buddhist teachings towards attaining something? Is it there? For example, you mentioned how you went from your journey, that you were wondering, you know, what is all this? And
yeah.
You went from one to the other.
Yeah.
You were in search of something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, for example, you know, if someone has a passion for dance.
Absolutely. I have a passion for music. I teach Tai Chi. All these things, that's fine. There's no problem with any of that. But you have to look at how much attachment you have to it. I have some really nice guitars and some other instruments. If someone comes in and smashes them and breaks them, I will find out how much attachment I have there and then. All right? Okay? And that will be really a test to how I deal with it. And so yes, you've got to follow. If you do it at university and you're going to get a job, do your job and do your job really, really well. And become the best you can and make lots of money. And with that money, be very compassionate and generous with that money. And you can do an extraordinary amount of good. I'll give you one instance. This one of the guys who lived in the Buddhist monastery in Melbourne, he went to my teacher and he said, very wealthy guy, worked for Microsoft and did very, very well. And he said, he was living at the monastery, at the centre, and he said to my teacher, he said, I want to buy a Porsche. What do you reckon? And my teacher said, fantastic car. Wonderful engineering, fabulous car. Will your car become your pleasure or your torture? Will you worry about the scratches? Will you worry, will you go out and polish it all the time? Will you spend days thinking about your car? Or will you use that wonderful piece of engineering and enjoy the drive? There's the difference. If it becomes an obsession, it is going to be difficult for you. If it becomes an enjoyment, that's fine. It becomes a problem if you have 5 Porsches in the garage. Do you see what I mean? There's nothing wrong. And you can be attached, it doesn't matter what you're attached to. You can be attached to anything. You can be attached to a lump of rock that's your meditation cushion in your cave, and it gets smashed and you can be upset for weeks. Or it's just a rock. And thanks for that, that's a really good point. It's where you really test your practice out on how you deal with stuff. You know? And when you fall flat on your face and you don't act very in accordance with your highest principles, then that's what I say keeps you honest. So you don't become spiritually arrogant. Oh yes, I have attained complete peace. Come on, flies. Or, how can I meditate with you making such a noise? Those kinds of lines. When those things come up, then you can realise where your spiritual practice is. Yes, eventually, and I know of some great practitioners, I was talking to one guy actually in Bali, and he knew this old lama who was highly, highly regarded. And he said people had to buy him clothes because he would just walk around in rags because he genuinely was uninterested in clothing or anything. But we can't all of a sudden dress in rags and say, oh, we're unattached, when we're still attached. So we have to work within the bounds of our own practice. But if we gradually, and if we actually do the practice and not just think about it, if we do our meditation practice and we look at the teachings, then gradually those things just fall away naturally. We don't grasp as much. And we look back and we go, oh yeah, well actually I got over that pretty quickly. I didn't obsess about that. Yeah, that happened, and I went, oh, well, big deal, you know? And that's where you start to see your practice making, you start to realise you're making ground, because you're not getting as ruffled by as much stuff. But it doesn't mean that you don't try hard in your work. But the difference between trying hard in your work and pushing people out of the road to get to the top of the tree is a different matter. Then you're starting to work with a lack of integrity. In my massage business, I was doing, and still do to a degree, not as much now, I would do house calls. And someone, a client of mine, said, "Oh, my daughter wants to do exactly the same thing as you're doing." I said, "Great, I'll tell her how to do it." And someone said, "What, you're going to tell the competition how to do your business?" I went, "Yeah." And they went, "Ooh, that's very brave of you." I said, "No, I'm not actually scared of the competition, and I want to help the girl do it." In the end, she didn't actually come and contact me, but I just felt very okay about being open about that. And I'm no big spiritual attainment, but to me that was just open being open. Yeah, I'll tell her how to do it, and wish her well, and you know, maybe I'll pass some clients on to her. Big deal. And so if you look at that and you try as much as possible to look at the tenets of Buddhism, look at the practices of the Buddha, and then try and bring them into your life in any subtle way that you can, or any big way that you can, then you start to make a difference with your life. And as you were saying with your auntie, the way she handled your uncle, that was a wonderful teaching. She just didn't get that ruffled. You know? When you do something wrong, you actually go and apologise. Say, "Look, I'm really sorry I did that wrong." Very easy. So we've got to suffering. The cause of suffering is our negative mind. Okay, our delusion, our negative mind. That's the reason we suffer. And to me, that's just so plainly clear that the Buddha told us that we have dissatisfaction. Then he told us why we have dissatisfaction. So the beginning of the teachings, really clear. Why do we have suffering? Because of our negative actions, which is karma. If every person in the world abided by the laws of karma, we would not have any wars, we would not have any hatred, anger, or suffering in that level. If every being abided with the laws of karma. If when you were putting your foot on a cockroach, your head started to squash, you would get it very quickly. Unfortunately, the gap between action and effect is longer than that. If you, when you were cheating on your tax return, you watched your bank account doing that, you'd stop immediately. Unfortunately, from the cause to the result, there is a gap. And so people think that a negative action brings a positive result. What about a person that robs a bank and gets away with the money? There's a negative action, and yet they got the loot. What's that about? Puzzling, isn't it? Exactly. The cause for them to get the money was not the robbing of the bank. But the cause for them to lose the money was the robbing of the bank. You cannot, and this is absolute irrefutable law, which I totally believe, and the Buddha has basically said is written in stone, a negative cause will not give you a positive result. And a positive cause will only give you a positive result. There's grey areas in life that we have to deal with. A friend of mine asked a Tibetan Lama, he said, "I had a cat with a tick in it." And he said, "If I left the tick in the cat would die. If I tried to pull the tick out, the tick would die. I don't want to kill. What do I do?" He said, "Well, what did you do?" He said, "Well, I tried to get the tick out the best way I could, but it actually broke off and couldn't do it." And the Lama said, "Well, you did the best you could in that circumstances. You didn't want to kill the tick, but you wanted the cat to survive, and the best thing you could do was try to help the cat survive. So he said, yeah, there's probably karma, but the intention was as pure as you could get it in that grey area. Okay. There's a spider. Some of you have gone through this one with me. You know this one, don't you? Has anyone heard my spider and the ant story? How many of you? Oh, okay, there's a few haven't. Okay, so there's a spider, ant walking along, gets caught in the web. I come along and I see the ant stuck in the web. All right, we'll do a show of hands. Who lets the spider eat the ant? Right, okay. Who rescues the ant? Okay. I this was put to me by a monk, and I had no idea. I was completely confused because I wasn't sure. But he put it really clearly. He said, if I rescue the ant, I've saved the ant. And I haven't killed the spider. And if the spider misses out on lunch, he won't die either. And he said, because I'm there, I'm part of the equation. I'm part of the cooperative cause. Now, if the ant was wrapped up in the web and undoing it would kill it, there's not much point, is there? You can't do much for that ant at all. But we're talking about an ant that just walks into a web and is a bit caught. And he said, well, if you're part of the equation, you do the best you can with what you've got. The spider won't die, and you've saved the ant. Not a bad solution. Spiders can hang in webs for ages without getting anything to eat, and they seem to be fine. So that was his answer, and I figured that was a pretty good answer. Again, you have to use your own wisdom within that situation. But, yeah?
You could get very tired interfering with all the natural...
Yeah, that's right. And that's why I'm saying you have to be really there at the place at the time. If you ran around, your whole mandate in life was to save ants from spider webs, you probably wouldn't be doing much for anybody else. And your poor sainted mother, who's not very well, wouldn't get a breakfast. I mean, you know, you've got it. Absolutely. The point is, if you're part of the equation at the time, then do the best you can with what you've got. And that's really the best that you can do at any particular time. And later on, you might think that, that wasn't as good as I could have done, or that was the wrong action. Then we have what I love to call in Buddhism intelligent regret. When we recognize a past action has not been very skillful, we learn from that and don't do it again. We don't sit around and beat ourselves up and go, oh, I'm terrible. We go, no, that wasn't really good. I shouldn't have done it in that way. I won't do that again. And you imprint that lesson in your mind so that you don't do it again. This is how you improve. Every time you do that, you are pushing yourself out of samsara, out of the quagmire of suffering. Every time you recognize an inaction. Because we will do plenty of wrong actions in our lives, but if you keep repeating it, then that truly is ignorance. But if you work it out and you go, no, I'm not going to do that again, that didn't work, then that's a very, very positive way of changing and transforming your life. Cause of suffering, cessation of suffering. This is one where we actually have to trust the Buddha's teachings, because we actually haven't experienced a cessation of suffering. So we can't necessarily say that it happens. But once we analyze a teacher, we analyze the teachings, we analyze the people practicing the teachings, and we start to accept the ideas, then we have to also have a degree of trust that the Buddha said there was a cessation of suffering, that we actually got to a place where we did not experience suffering. And it wasn't annihilation, but there was a place where the conscious mind did not experience suffering. You go? And so that was the cessation of suffering. And the Buddha then taught, the Fourth Noble Truth, there was a path out of suffering, and that's the Dharma path. The practices of the Buddha. So those four teachings encompass the whole of the path to enlightenment, how to achieve enlightenment. Having compassion for all beings, having the wisdom to see how to work with our mind, and having the renunciation of negative states of mind and negative actions really covers the whole thing, and it's within that escape out of suffering. Because all beings, without exception, want happiness, and no beings whatsoever want suffering of any kind. We will do everything to avoid suffering. Look at the pharmaceutical companies. Every one of those pills is to avoid suffering. It's clear as a bell. But we have to know how to do that. And unfortunately, gaining more and more money for the sake of just gaining the money, and also being ruthless with it and causing dissatisfaction along the way and ripping money out of people's hands and paying workers less money if you're a boss and doing all those horrible things to people. There was one guy in America who became a senator. I heard about him the other day, quite a famous guy. And he was head of a corporation, and he put his wages in accordance with all these workers, and he even took a pay cut to give his workers more money. When he ran for presidency against Richard Nixon, he disclosed everything, completely open, where all his funds came from, everything. And he was beaten for the presidency because he was so open. But this guy was extraordinary. He ran a company where all the workers just thought he was fabulous, and a successful company. And he took a pay cut to give his workers more money. And his pay originally was indexed to the workers' pay. So if they got a raise, he got a raise. And at one point, I don't think he took a pay cut. He just didn't take the raise. He didn't take the raise, but they did. Because he had enough. You know? And that's the amazing thing, that when we, I mean, how many boats can we ski behind? We only need one. Well, maybe two. I heard someone talk about shoes. Someone said, how many shoes do you need? You have all the pairs you need plus one more. Someone will relate to that. Anyway, we've got about 10 minutes to go. Are there any questions? That's almost impossible to answer that, because the teacher that I came across didn't do that. I understand that, but on the highest level, if you said to the normal person in the street, you don't have to look for anything, all right? You don't have to search, there's no reason. What do you think would happen to them generally? I think you might find they'll just go, oh, okay. Yeah, that's all right. And I think the only way that you come to that understanding is from the search. I don't think if you get it at the beginning that you will get that truth. That's a very, very refined truth. There is no path, no teachers, the Heart Sutra. I don't think you get that unless you've done some quite strong searching, because otherwise it's a bit like saying, oh, well, don't do anything, everything's perfect. You know? That, in a sense, that's true in the light of emptiness and total reality. But in terms of a person's life, if you walked up to someone that was having a really difficult time in their lives and say, look, don't worry, it doesn't matter. They'd go, yeah, but I'm suffering. If you said, oh, well, there's no truth to it, it's completely empty. Do you see what I'm getting at? Unless they're right, unless they're right in the pocket of understanding, you know, like with my son, who's a kind of a loose Buddhist, you'd call it. When he complains about something, and I go, well, you know, he goes, yeah, okay, it's my karma. Okay, got it. And so on some level, as much as he wants to complain about it, he also gets it. But ultimately, when you get it completely, you totally accept it. That's the nature of it. I mean, I've just been reading an amazing book, actually. It's kind of got Buddhist things. It's called The Antidote. And it's called For Those People That Don't Believe in Positive Thinking, which is a really kind of heretical book. And it counteracts all the New Age Anthony Robbins and Brian Tracy who say, strive for success, you know, and they do these seminars and the music's thumping and you can be successful and you can make $100,000 a week. And what they're selling is, if you do this, you will be happy. It's not true. If that was true, every multimillionaire would be exceedingly happy. And it's not true. I know some very, very wealthy people. And you would too. You'll know some wealthy people. And if you look at them, their life's not much different. They get a toothache. They get the flu, you know. They lose a bit of money. I know someone that lost, what was it? They were worth $400 million, heard of this story. During the global financial crisis, they lost $200 million. And someone said, big deal. They've still got $200 million. And the person said, oh no, they're beside themselves. They've lost half their money. See the difference? And for them, that would have been unbelievably painful. The houses that they owned and the cars that they owned and the things that they did would be severely jeopardized, and so it was suffering. And yet, still they had $200 million. But they lost half their money. There you go, exactly. But for them, that's suffering. And so the reality of suffering is there. In the end, and you're right, and this is the same as you, the money is only relative. What is it? If you really look at it, it's a piece of paper, and even in that situation, you don't even get the $200 million in a little box, do you? It's just numbers in the air on computers. And yet we place so much importance to it. You know? If you have is anyone here like shoes? Ah, I hear a giggle. Imagine you had the opportunity of buying something that you wanted and you had $10 million to do it. Right? Whether it was shoes or a boat or something. Well, $20 million, $100 million. I can play with figures. $1,000 million. $1 billion to buy anything that you want. Then what? You've got it. So what? Half the time our anticipation of buying something is more pleasurable than owning the object. You've just bought yourself $1 billion worth of shoes. Then you go, where am I going to put them? I've got so many shoes. And if you start to play with it, stuff like that, you start to realise that we become attached to just the silliest things. And that we don't have to.
Marcus.
Do what?
I remember seeing a picture of all the collection of shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
huge collection.
I went and saw them.
Did you?
Yeah.
Were you envious?
They're a bit too small for me.
good answer. The next question. Forget it. All right, we're gonna finish there. Thank you very much. Are there any more questions?
Yeah,
please.
One last question, which is a little bit sidetracked off the thing tonight.
Okay.
Is practicing martial arts sort of contradictory to Buddhism?
Is what?
Practicing martial arts.
Oh,
yes.
Fantastic question. is practicing martial arts contradictory to Buddhism? Yes, it is. If your mandate for practicing martial arts is harming somebody, if you can find a martial art that doesn't harm somebody, then you can practice that one. Does that make sense?
Most of the
tenets
are self-discipline, aren't they?
The teacher of my teacher, Master Shang Shang Wan, famous Tai Chi master, was able to pretty much disarm everybody of all disciplines, even when he was 80, without harming them. He could spin them onto the floor gently. He could repel any attacker. His skill was so refined that he was never had to harm anybody. So, absolutely. If the mandate is to cause harm and suffering and killing, absolutely wrong. If you can practice a martial art where even as a defense that you're able to disarm someone or even protect someone, if you could put someone in an arm lock to stop them murdering somebody, then that's fantastic.
Aikido, for example.
Hmm?
Aikido,
exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So there's no contradiction. It depends on intention. If I'm learning karate, say, to cause injury, harm, and death, then that's completely against Buddhism. So it depends on motivation behind it. So yeah, Aikido, Tai Chi, really any of the arts, if they're done in at the highest level of skill, can be a protection for other beings and very good for the body. Yep.
Everything hypothetical, but what about the Buddhist view on defense? The Buddhist view on defense.
Defense. Oh, like probably a good idea that every country in the world has exactly the amount of defense equal to each other, so there's a complete stalemate. That would be the things. I don't think there's anything wrong with a deterrent, but I'm not, you know, there's no way. During the Vietnam War, I was in a position of being conscripted into the army. And I told my mother at the time, I said, look, I'll go and do the army training, because there's no harm there, but I am not going to Vietnam. And she said, well, you might have to. I said, well, they'll have to catch me first, I'll go bush. I am absolutely not going there to be in a war.
I was sort of aiming more at like a personal...
Personal defence?
Personal defence or family defence or, you know, friend defence or...
Absolutely.
You know, sometimes the situation pushes you into, you know, whether you might consider the most peaceful person, sometimes you just have to act.
Again, you have to... there's a difference between defence and the desire to kill. Do you see what I mean?
Yep.
The Buddhist tenet is not to kill and not to harm. So if I was in a situation, as much as I can say hypothetically, and hopefully I never get there, my mandate would not be to kill that person. All right? And so that would be the shift. If something like a broken arm came out of it, and hopefully it's not mine, that prevented murder and suffering at a high level, then that, I don't see that as a big loss, okay? That again wouldn't be preferable. In terms of my own self-defense, the best self-defense is about 100 meters in the other direction. And I would do that every possible time. Absolutely. If someone wanted to abuse me and call me a coward, I would agree with them 100%. The last thing I would ever want to do is fight. And the danger too for me, being a martial artist, that if I had to protect myself and like happened to that guy on the cross, someone slipped over and hit the head in the concrete and died, that would be the greatest tragedy for me. So the last thing I ever want to do is to get into conflict with anyone. It's far too dangerous. Too many things can go wrong. So I would never test my ability unless it was absolutely at the last possible opportunity. Yes, I would protect my life, but it wouldn't be at the mandate of killing someone at all, ever. As far as I know. I can't. You don't know what happens with the mind. This is why Buddhist training is so important. We want to be peaceful and loving, but we lose our temper. You know? We want to be able to do exactly the right thing, and we say something wrong to somebody. That's why we have to keep training. And that's what keeps us honest with our practice, when we look at ourselves and go, yeah, well, I haven't cracked that one. They say that the great, great masters, even in their dreams, they don't have negative dreams. When the mind never even has a negative or an angry or an aggressive dream, then we're starting to make progress. So, you know, a little bit of a way to go. All right, thank you very much, everybody. Thank you for coming. Good to see you all. See you next time.